From Indiana to Florida, Minnesota to Nevada, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, draconian business closure orders have failed to stem the spread of COVID-19, but they have inflicted tremendous economic damage. So says Phil Kirpin of American Commitment. He is here to explain. U.S. Senator Rob Portman of Ohio has announced his retirement, triggering a scramble for his seat. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Former President Donald Trump unleashed historic economic growth by cutting federal regulations. But Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports President Joe Biden has begun to undo that progress. And Pennsylvania's health secretary has been appointed Assistant U.S. Health Secretary by President Biden. On this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College says the promotion is without merit. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Tens of thousands of businesses have gone out of business due to harsh closure orders and restrictions imposed largely by blue state governors. Now some are reversing course, but the damage has been done. To learn more, we turn to Phil Kirpin, who is president of American Commitment. Phil, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Phil, after nearly a year of the left and Democrats, one and the same, telling us that we have to have these draconian lockdowns in order to stop the spread of the COVID-19 virus, we're now seeing folks like the governor of New York, the mayor of Chicago saying, hey, we have to open up. Are they now admitting that this has been a failure?
We're at least starting to see some sort of divisions on the left on that question. Both of those are kind of interesting in that you got Cuomo saying, open things up, we can't do this much longer, and I'm not sure de Blasio agrees, and so you've got sort of a split among Democrats in New York, and same thing in Chicago. You got the mayor saying, open up, and the Democratic governor saying, close. And so there's some dissension in the ranks among the Democrats where they had been in pretty much lockstep on locking everything down, and I think it's because they're seeing that the consequences are so dire in terms of the economic harms, and the benefits in terms of virus spread are minimum to non-existent. California, Loman, now has more total cumulative cases per capita than Florida, which, you know, in California has been locked down for 9 months. And so what was it all for?
Let's take the two parts of what you just said separately, the impact on the economy and the impact on the spread of the virus, Phil. First of all, the impact on the spread of the virus. Of course, nobody knew at the beginning of this how to stop the spread of a virus during a pandemic. But tell me a little bit more about stopping the spread. Have we seen numbers dip in places like New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, where they've had harsh shutdowns? And conversely, what have you seen in Florida and the success that they have had there?
What we've seen in states like New York is that in New York City, where they had the massive, massive, massive wave in the spring of last year, they've had a very, very mild second wave this year. The rest of the state, where they had much less in the spring, they've had much more now. And so it sort of is filling in. I mean, the thing about a pandemic, and this is a real pandemic, is pan means everywhere. And the places that have been spared, it's generally not because of their genius, brilliant political leadership and policies. It's generally some mixture of seasonality and luck, essentially. And what we're seeing is all these places are converging, essentially. The places that were spared have their turn, and that's what we've seen with California. And places that were hit hard in the summer are being hit much less so now. And it's interesting. Florida, though, is, I think, performing even better than the other southern states that got hit hard in the summer. And I think it's because they have been open. I think they got relatively cheap population immunity in that they got a lot of spread in the summer when it's less likely to cause severe disease. And that's serving them well now, which is why some other areas that have similar geography, similar humidity, similar temperature are being hit harder than they are. But it's extraordinarily complex, Loman. The idea that we understand this well enough to effectively stop it through government policies is the height of arrogance, the height of hubris. We just haven't seen it work really anywhere. But these policies do carry enormous costs, enormous harms, despite not being very effective in terms of benefit.
Talk a little bit more about that, Phil, the harm, economic and also emotional, psychological that these lockdowns have caused?
Well, we're in a severe mental health crisis in this country from the lockdowns and the isolation, especially among young people, young adults and teenagers. And we had a pretty bad mental health situation even before this. The last sort of pre-pandemic survey on suicidal thoughts among young adults 18 to 24 was in 2018, and 11% of young adults in that age bracket said they had considered suicide. In June, the CDC did a survey, and it was over 25%. So it had more than doubled from a pretty high level to start with to a really shocking, kind of devastating number. And we don't know how many youth actually went through with suicide. We have a theory in this country that you don't report those numbers until several years after because you don't want to encourage copycats, what they call social contagion. So we don't have the numbers on that. But we do know that given that young people are at very, very low risk with coronavirus, we've almost certainly had more suicides among teenagers and young adults in their 20s than we have coronavirus deaths. And that's a pretty disturbing consequence because it means we've essentially imposed a greater harm through our policies on young people than the virus imposed on them.
So all these lockdowns have not been effective or overly effective in stopping the spread of COVID-19. We now have the collateral damage economically and emotionally. One of the successes of this has been the rapid development of a vaccine. President Biden is saying that he plans on delivering 100 million doses, vaccinating 100 million people in his first 100 days in office. Do you see the infrastructure there, Phil, to allow that to happen? And what can we look forward to in terms of actually getting this vaccine out there and hopefully bringing this pandemic under control?
Well, I actually think it's a relatively low target. I think he's sort of under-promising so that he can over-deliver, which is kind of a traditional thing politicians do. Trump did the opposite. He overpromised on everything, and he largely delivered. But the 100 million should be very achievable. We're actually on pace to exceed that even without an increase. Now, we could have supply constraints coming up, depending on if they're able to maintain this pace of production or not. But there's good reason to believe that we're going to have additional vaccines approved within the next several weeks. It's possible that within the next week or two, we could get a readout on the Johnson & Johnson trial. And they have two separate trials for that vaccine. One is a one-dose regimen and one is a two-dose regimen. If the one-dose regimen proves highly effective and safe, that would be a tremendous boon to the whole vaccination effort because, of course, you'd only need the one dose as opposed to two.
We have been talking with Phil Kirpin. He is president of American Commitment. And Phil, we have you on regularly, but sometimes we have new listeners who don't know about American Commitment. So tell us a bit about your organization.
We're a national free market advocacy group. We work really on all the fiscal, economic, and regulatory issues. And what we do, it's a little different from some of the other groups. We don't do original research. We try to focus on the policy fights that are really on the margin in Washington, whether it's legislative or regulatory, where a little bit of citizen engagement, writing letters to Congress or to the executive branch, can make a difference and tip some of these outcomes in a more free market direction. And all of our stuff is on our website, AmericanCommitment.org. And Lohman, we're going to be fighting a lot of regulations here over the next couple of years because the Biden administration is going to be back to the future with all of the stuff we saw under Obama and maybe worse. So that's going to be our main focus.
The policy battles are going to become very heated here very quickly, and we will be hearing more from Phil Kirpin at American Commitment. Phil, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Lohman. Have a good one.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We have a very ambitious agenda today. We have things legislative, things political, and things economic. So, Scott, first of all, welcome back to the program. And let's start out talking about politics. The U.S. Senate, a big retirement announcement this past week.
Yeah, that's right. Senator Rob Portman announced that he will not be seeking reelection. He's a Republican out of Ohio. And we know that Ohio is just one of those swing states that is incredibly expensive. It has several large media markets. And we know this is going to be one of the most expensive Senate races in the 2022 cycle. And I think it will be the most expensive Senate race in Ohio's history. We're also looking at open races in your state of Pennsylvania, in North Carolina. I think there will be several other states that we see some retirements in the coming weeks and months where senators that have been around a long time are just ready to hang it up. And then you're going to have competitive races in states like Arizona and Georgia. And, you know, we're watching all those closely to see who the top candidates are. In Ohio, there's a lot of people that are kind of dipping their toe in the water and thinking that they might run for the Senate seat, because open Senate seats only happen every so often. And in Ohio, we've got a couple of very, very strong conservative candidates, with Jim Jordan possibly being a candidate. Jim Jordan is a strong conservative fighter, founder of the House Freedom Caucus, and he also coincidentally has over $5 million in his campaign account right now. Another really good candidate is Josh Mandel. Josh was the Treasury Secretary for Ohio and previously ran for the United States Senate and lost, and then he ran again in 2018, but ended up dropping out of that race due to personal reasons in, I think, about January of 2018. So Josh has also got a ton of money left over from that campaign. He's got $4.3 million in his campaign account, and I think he's given it a strong look. And then you've got some other Republican establishment candidates like Steve Stivers and Anthony Gonzalez that are giving it a look, but they don't have a ton of money right now. And the question is, can they raise millions and millions of dollars for a big, expensive statewide race?
We, of course, are going to keep a very close eye on all of this, with the United States Senate currently split dead even at 50-50. So all these races are going to be hugely important. Let's switch gears to legislative matters. President Biden has put forth a proposal for another $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. What's happening with that, Scott?
Yeah, $1.9 trillion. This is already on top of the previous five iterations of coronavirus pandemic assistance that the American people have received through various legislative packages dating back to last spring, right? And so right now, President Biden is looking for a big bipartisan deal, and he knows that it's tough. There are eight Republican senators that are in a working group with eight Democrat senators, and they're trying to find a consensus that can get them over the hump of 60 votes. Now, I personally don't think that Mitch McConnell is going to allow those eight senators just to join with the Democrats and pick off two others and have it be exactly 60 votes, right? That's poor management of a Senate minority. If there's going to be a bipartisan package, I predict it would have more like 80 votes. And so they're looking for the sweet spot. I know that there's a lot of senators that are interested in coronavirus stimulus checks. Other senators are more interested in focusing on the infrastructure related to delivering a vaccination to the American people more quickly. And then you have others that are, you know, sort of in the, hey, the Democrats have all these outrageous proposals, we shouldn't be going along with any of them. And then so the question is, what can they get accomplished in a bipartisan fashion? The White House now is entertaining the idea of taking that $1.9 trillion level all the way down to maybe $600 or $800 billion, and then fighting for the rest on a reconciliation package. Now, I think we'll remember from the experience of tax reform and the Obamacare repeal effort, there's only so much that the Congress can do on reconciliation. There are limitations. It's supposed to be budgetary in nature. So if it's a fiscal idea and a stimulus idea, yeah, you can do that through reconciliation. But if it's a policy idea, many of which are that the Democrats are seeking to insert into these packages, then I think you get into questions about whether it would violate the privilege of a reconciliation package, meaning would it have the ability to be voted on for final passage with only a simple majority in the Senate.
Also this past week, a bit of unusual volatility, at least the cause of which unusual, in the equity markets. A lot of people a little mystified. What's happening there?
I think that there's a new trend for a lot of people with technology, and they're taking advantage of applications that have no brokerage fees like Robinhood, and they're using other technology platforms like Reddit to really work together to promote the stock sale of certain stocks that might not really be that valuable, but when a lot of people are purchasing them all at once at the same time, then certainly the price is going to soar. You've got a lot of trading companies that have automatic sale prices that are built into their own technology, and it's really created this big headache for hedge funds, for NASDAQ, for all these traders that are really trying to ensure that the larger investors are being protected. And so I think that you've kind of got like these smart folks that are working together on Reddit that are currently promoting the sale of GameStop and Nokia and AMC. But think about it this way too. People like Dave Portnoy at Barstool, he's got millions and millions of followers and people check in with him. And when you've got millions of trades happening all at once on the same stocks, certainly prices are going to be affected. So I think it's been kind of interesting to watch what the SEC and what the NASDAQ are doing to react. Certainly, I think that Club for Growth embraces the idea that there should be a free market in trading, and we shouldn't be really coming after low-dollar investors because they've figured out a way to make money.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, as always, tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We have over 500,000 members from all 50 states in the country. And if your listeners are interested in checking us out, you can look us up at clubforgrowth.org. And our Twitter handle is at Club for Growth with the number 4. You can actually sign up to be a member of Club for Growth for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, again, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
The Biden administration has set the stage for a massive re-regulation of the U.S. economy after years of regulation cutting by his predecessor. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has details.
One of the first things that President Donald Trump did after taking office in 2017 was to issue an executive order. It was Executive Order 13771, if you're keeping score at home. And this executive order mandated that the federal government revoke at least two regulations for every new regulation that it passed. One of the first things that President Joe Biden did after taking office 2 weeks ago was to revoke that executive order and to issue new rules for federal regulations that promised to grow the federal regulatory state to new record highs. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at the new regulatory regime that has come into power along with President Joe Biden in the past 2 weeks, and taking a close look at a couple of these executive actions that the new president has made since taking office just about 2 weeks ago. Now, even though the Trump administration did plenty to grow the size of government during its 4 years in power, and I'm talking, of course, about things like tariffs and a massive hike in federal spending, the one-in, two-out regulatory policy was really one of the true successes of the Trump years from a small government perspective. According to Clyde Wayne Cruz, a vice president at the Competitive Enterprise Institute who tracks the size and cost of the federal regulatory state, the Trump administration actually revoked about 3.2 regulations for every new one that it approved. So actually went above and beyond that initial promise of one-in, two-out. It's fair to assume, of course, that the Biden administration won't be following that same path. Biden's first regulatory actions are all about gutting the restraint of the past 4 years. According to Cruz, he told me last week that under the guise of modernizing regulatory review, what the Biden plan appears to be doing is imposing a twofold change on how the costs and benefits of potential federal regulations are weighed. Now, on one hand, Biden's approach is likely to elevate completely unquantifiable aims as benefits. In one of the executive orders that Biden signed shortly after taking office, he said that our nation today faces serious challenges, including a massive global pandemic, major economic downturn, systemic racial inequality, and the undeniable reality of accelerating climate change. The memo goes on to state that the goal of producing a set of recommendations for improving and modernizing regulatory review should provide concrete suggestions on how the regulatory review process can promote public health and safety, economic growth, social welfare, racial justice, environmental stewardship, human dignity, equity, and the interests of future generations. His first set of executive actions to deal with regulations would also revise previous rules to fully account, he says, and this is a direct quote, for regulatory benefits that are difficult or impossible to quantify, which means the administration isn't even really trying to hide the fact that would mean a bureaucrat who can conceive of any way that a new regulation might help improve the environment or solve racial injustice, then that regulation can move forward even if the benefits of doing so are impossible to quantify or actually find. Now, that's a recipe for more regulation, of course, and it's also a recipe for less oversight of which regulations might actually be needed or worthwhile and which are just advancing a political agenda. But wait, there's more. Biden also ditched Executive Order 13777. That's another early Trump-era executive order that established regulatory reform officers and task forces at many federal agencies. The input of those individuals were actually pretty important in terms of reducing the number of regulations that got through. It was a position that was entirely meant to just do essentially cost-benefit analyses of new regulations. Cruz says that the aim appears to be to put weight on the scales of whether or not to regulate in such a way that the answer will almost always be in the affirmative, replacing market operation and civil society with government in the pursuit of a range of non-quantifiable goals, even without legislation from Congress. Agencies are being unleashed, he says, to issue guidance, memoranda, notices, circulars, bulletins, letters, interpretations, and a whole bunch of other stuff that CEI collectively refers to as regulatory dark matter. This, of course, isn't really all that surprising. Of course, the Biden administration is not the Trump administration, after all, and Democrats have been chomping at the bit to get the federal regulatory state revving up again after 4 years where it was operating in first gear. One of those first memos that Biden issued also states that his new regulatory regime should, quote, serve as a tool to affirmatively promote regulations. And I think that really sums it all up. The bottom line here is that this should show why it's not enough for Republicans and libertarians and conservatives to merely roll back the administrative state when they take control of the White House periodically. Because, as we're seeing now, as soon as a Democrat takes over again, any progress can be and will be immediately wiped away. Serious, lasting reform of the regulatory state will require congressional action. And I know, that's even a ridiculous thing to suggest, but that's honestly what it will take. And electing another Republican president or another small government president who wants to limit the growth of the regulatory state will only be as good as that president's term. So for now, get ready for regulations to start spewing forth from Washington once again. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of the Biden administration and everything that's going on during this transition period in American politics at Reason.com. You can check out Clyde Wing Cruz's work as well at CEI.org. He does some phenomenal work on the federal regulatory state, as does everyone else at CEI. I'm sure they will have plenty to keep them busy in the coming months and years. And once again, for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me again right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
In a triumph of identity politics over qualifications, Pennsylvania's state health secretary has been appointed the new assistant U.S. health secretary. Dr. Paul Kangor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this American Radio Journal commentary.
As a native of Pennsylvania, I can tell you that since last May, numerous Pennsylvanians have wanted Dr. Rachel Levine removed as our state's health secretary. At the height of the COVID surge last spring, politicians and pundits throughout my state called for Levine's resignation because of the health secretary's disastrous decision to move COVID-infected patients into Pennsylvania nursing homes, where the death rate exploded to levels worse than even the state of New York. But Levine did not go. Democratic Governor Tom Wolf, a cultural radical, refused to let Levine go. Instead, liberals rallied to Levine as nothing short of a transgendered hero being victimized by the brute sin of what the Huffington Post calls relentless misgendering. They sought to make Levine a martyr. Levine's critics protested that their objections had nothing to do with misgendering Levine, but rather with Levine misdirecting COVID patients in their nursing facilities. Their objections, however, fell on deaf ears. Levine stayed. But alas, coming to the rescue of us Pennsylvanians is an unlikely ally, President Joe Biden. The day before his inauguration, Biden heralded a new era for transgender rights when he tapped Rachel Levine to be his incoming assistant health secretary. So Pennsylvanians' demands that Levine leave are resolved. Rachel Levine is headed to Washington. In so doing, Joe Biden is being praised by cultural revolutionaries for fulfilling the bold proclamation he made a year ago. Quote, "Let's be clear, transgender equality is the civil rights issue of our time," unquote. And have no doubts, to liberals, that's what matters most. Biden selects transgender doctor Rachel Levine as assistant health secretary, beamed the Washington Post headline, quoting Biden, "She is a historic and deeply qualified choice to help lead our administration's health efforts." Pennsylvanians, however, beg to differ. Of course, they need to know that when Biden and fellow progressives talk qualifications, it's identity politics qualifications that they have foremost in mind. Nothing, truly nothing, animates the modern liberal mind more than identity politics. You are a person to be placed in a category, period. Outsiders unfamiliar with the Pennsylvania situation need to know that Levine largely avoided everyone's radar throughout Levine's four-year tenure. But late last May, as COVID took off in the Northeast, Pennsylvania had registered a staggering proportion of its COVID deaths in nursing homes. The estimates were 70%. A devastating investigative piece was published in the Bucks County Courier Times. It documented the starkly disproportionate death rate in nursing homes, which was way higher in Pennsylvania than surrounding states, even exceeding angry Andrew Cuomo's New York, which, with a nursing home death rate of 17%, looked idyllic compared to Pennsylvania's 70%. The report noted that on March 29, Pennsylvania joined New York and other northeastern states in, quote, ordering nursing homes to admit medically stable residents infected with the coronavirus, unquote, despite warning from groups like the American Healthcare Association that such health directives, quote, could unnecessarily cost more lives, unquote. Yes, these were obvious warnings. Who, after all, but a fool would move infected COVID-19 patients into nursing facilities? What was the other option, moving them into Walmarts? And who was responsible? The report singled out Dr. Rachel Levine. Moreover, we soon learned that Dr. Levine's own 95-year-old mother was, wisely, simultaneously removed from a nursing home by Dr. Rachel Levine. Nice, Dr. Levine. Could we move our mothers, too? Answers were demanded from Levine, but Levine's progressive protectors rallied because of the transgender issue, which was used to beat back Levine's critics. And now, here we are, January, February 2021, and Joe Biden has chosen Rachel Levine as his assistant health secretary. Says Biden, quote, "Dr. Rachel Levine will bring the steady leadership and essential expertise that we need to get people through this pandemic. No matter their zip code, race, religion, sexual orientation, gender identity, and meet the public health needs of our country in this critical moment and beyond. She is a historic and deeply qualified choice," unquote. No, Joe. If this was about Levine's work with the COVID pandemic, this would not be the essential, historic, and deeply qualified choice. Levine's handling of COVID would actually be a disqualifier to those more concerned with the health secretary's work on the pandemic rather than Levine's gender. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WRNN-FM and WKNB-FM in Warren, Pennsylvania, along with WWNC-AM in Asheville, North Carolina. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.